Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined on another snowy day in Washington, D.C. by David Frum, a senior editor at The Atlantic and longtime pariah in the conservative movement. Is that, by the way, hey, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I sometimes get these introductions where people say things like that. I remember once doing a podcast where the host really laid it on so thick that you think I was sleeping on top of a sewer grate in Washington, huddling for warmth.
Well, you know, is pariah too strong a word?
No, I think my pariah stand status. I mean, I was a pariah before pariah was cool.
I know.
So my status on this goes back a ways, and I began to get into trouble. I think it dates to the financial crisis of 2009, and that was because, and this is a, I have a double life. I'm also active in the business world. We have a family business, and I worked on that. In fact, after I lost my late father in 2013, I actually ran it for a few years. And so I had we were in financial markets in 2008, 2009, and I had a very close-up view of what happens when General Electric cannot borrow money. And so I was a strong advocate in 2000, 2008, 2009 of throw everything at this. Print money, because this airship is hitting Earth. So everybody should be like, everything, like get all hands on deck, blow all the air you can into that giant balloon, because we are heading for a 1931 style crash. And then I became very disaffected from the Tea Party movement, which kept calling for, it called for a lot of things, but if you took the Tea Party movement at face value, they were calling for a massive deflationary response to the worst economic crisis since the 30s. And so I sort of got off, I got off the train at that station, and then I got into probably more trouble because, while I was no fan of the Affordable Care Act or the Obamacare approach, I do think it's a good idea, especially when you're in the midst of a near depression, to have health insurance for everybody. And I thought that I was a big advocate of Mitt Romney, and I liked what he had done in Massachusetts, and thought, you know, using competitive markets and private insurers to try to reach the goal of what, if not totally universal, that may not be feasible, but near universal care, I thought those were good things. And so that put me on a path that took me away. So I was going in, while most of the conservative world was wheeling in one direction, I was walking in the other, and there was a big gap.
Yeah, as I recall, you were at AEI at that time, right?
Right.
And you suggested, and you correct me on this because I'm just doing this off the top of my head now, you suggested that the Republicans might actually want to compromise on Obamacare, since the Democrats were going to be ramming it through, and therefore it was the prudent thing for the Republicans to work with them, which of course was very contrary to what the mood of the Tea Party and the Republicans were at that particular time. That was one of your breaking points, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got sacked for that from AEI. But here was my point of view on this, and I think events have confirmed me right. The general view in the conservative world in 2009, 2010 was that Obamacare was going to be a replay of Clinton Care. And what happened in 1993 and 94, that the Republican world stopped President Clinton's approach to health care. And then that defeat for the Democrats was followed by the capture of both houses of Congress in the election of 1994, a staggering victory. The Republicans had not had the House since the Truman administration, and a lot of people said, right, let's rerun that movie. To which I said, the Democrats have also seen that movie, and they know how it comes out. And this time, in 2009-10, they have a much stronger grip on Congress and a much more cohesive party than they did in 1993-94. They are not going to let you beat them. Meanwhile, this plan, while it's full of obnoxious elements that are there to invite you to negotiate the obnoxious elements away, also had some good elements, some restrictions on the future growth of Medicare, for example. And then I brought in a value view, which is, you know, we've got all these people out of work. They're going to be out of work for a long time. We've had a lot of trouble delivering wage increases. If we could just simply take away the anxiety about healthcare for millions of Americans, that would be a generational contribution to stabilizing the society in the face of this terrible economic crisis. So this is both a normative argument that more universal health care would be a good thing. And as a practical argument, you're not going to win this fight, so do business. And everyone assured me that that was crazy, that the Republicans would win. And after they lost, well, they would take the House. And I argued, look, congressional majorities come and go. This program is forever. And Republicans will, I predicted in 2010, be fighting in the 2020s with blood, toil, tears, and sweat to get things they could have had for the asking in 2009.
You know, I know this is an old story, but you got fired from AEI for taking this position. And the reason I'm sort of dwelling on this is because I'm trying to get a sense of fairness to AEI.
Yeah, it wasn't just that I took this position. It was that I do have an unfortunate tendency to put things in pungent ways. So what I was fired for was not exactly the position. I was fired for then after the defeat of the Republicans and after the triumph of Obama, I wrote a very pungent blog post about it. I think that was the, in fairness, that was the thing that set me off.
So you were done by the pungency.
Well, yes, I embedded it in a 50-page paper that no one read. I think I would have gotten away with it.
See, talking with you is very awkward for me. Let me just explain this because, you know, with the disillusionment of Trump and what happened, you know, I went back and tried to figure out what just happened. And then I started coming across things that you wrote like a decade ago saying, you know, the conservatism was tired and confused, that I think you wrote back in 2008 that the right was experiencing a crisis of followership. And so one of the things that I always, I mean, I really wrestle with this is why I missed all of this at the time, what it was that led me to think that the conservative movement was something that it wasn't, when guys like you were out there and you were apparently willing to pay the price. And I have to admit to you that I was not paying attention to what you were saying, you know, in 2008, 2009, 2010. And it's only when everything basically turns to you know what that you go, all right, you know, there were storm warnings out there. And this is the real danger of tribalism, that when people stand up and say, hey, we're headed in the right direction, and they become the pariahs that you don't get listened to. So I'm a little bit chagrined about all of this because – so well, let me ask you this. So
that's all very generous of you to say, and I thank you. And I remember during those periods when it was and we have two dogs, so we meet that test, and, you know, if you're watching, you want a friend, get a dog. But my wife would sometimes, you know, this is a little tough. And yeah. I said, I'm guaranteeing you, I'm going to get fantastic eulogies at my funeral.
That's taking the long view. It is, you know, but clearly you were able to basically to say, all right, you know, and then you understood very early on the price you pay for stepping out of that tribe. I mean, there's a reason why people, you know, huddle together. You have a support network. You have, you know, professional friends. You have social friends, and suddenly you find yourself naked, and of course you experience the strange new respect of taking these positions. Do you think of yourself, people would say, well, David Frum is really not a conservative. What you just described is he basically became a liberal. He's a never Trump liberal Democrat. Do you think of yourself that way?
Well, Jeff Goldberg, my editor at The Atlantic, has a very funny joke. I have a big piece coming out about immigration in the next issue of The Atlantic. And Jeff said, when people read this, when all my new liberal friends read it, they're going to say, wait a minute, David Frum is David Frum?
We shouldn't have trusted him.
So I have to say, I'm not 100% consistent on this point. I sometimes forget. But what I try to do when I describe myself is I adhere to the adjective conservative. I'm a very conservative person. I am, as you heard with my answer about healthcare, my concerns about social stability and my anxiety that American society is less stable than Americans usually think. That's a foundational premise of my politics. But I've stopped using the phrase a conservative because you know, at some level, you have to say, look, if all the people in the conservative world think this is what it means to be a conservative, and I'm not that, at some level, then the point of these labels is to help people identify you. What I do remain And this is maybe the opposite of what a lot of people in your situation and those of some of our friends, I remain a registered Republican. I do put my political – I didn't vote Republican in 2016. I live in the District of Columbia, so we don't have any candidates on the ballot in off years, but I would have voted for a Democratic candidate in 2018 had there been one. And if Donald Trump is on the ticket in 2020, I will vote for the Democratic opponent. But I do regard myself as a Republican, and I see my personal future in the Republican world as I do see myself as a creature of center-right, not center-left mm-hmm. politics.
Are you worried, or I should say, how worried are you by what's going on in the Democratic Party, the lurch to the left? What I'm seeing is that a lot of never-Trump conservatives who really would like to have some sort of a center-right, center-left dialogue are having this moment where they realize, okay, the Democratic Party is not reaching out to folks like me. In fact, it's embracing policies that are a bridge too far. That if it does not reelect Donald Trump, certainly is going to leave us very, very much in the wilderness. Do you share that view?
Well, as I said, I'm not a Democrat. I don't expect him to return to me. And I think part of the price of Trump, and the Republicans and conservatives are going to have to eat this. So when the Democrats are going to do very well in the 2020s, and they're going to do very, very well for a long time running against Donald Trump. So part of what you get when you indulge yourself with the Trump support is you get a reaction. Now, some of that reaction, I think, is not dangerous to the long-term stability of the country. If some of these economic issues of the country, I mean, the country has moved so far in a plutocratic direction. You know, Medicare for all is not the way I would fix healthcare problems, mm-hmm. but it doesn't scare me. I think it's not a great idea, but it doesn't scare me. Two years of the Amy Klobuchar position on education, that the first 2 years of community college are going to be heavily subsidized by the state. Again, don't agree with it. Doesn't scare me. What scares me is that in and this is a cycle. We can't say which is the chicken, which is the egg. Is the Democratic turn the use of white and male as epithets and the division of people into those groups? That's what scares me. And one of the things I thought was a sign of that the Democratic Party has more antibodies than the Republican Party did is the way the Democratic leadership turned on Ilhan Omar, the junior most mm-hmm. member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, when she indulged with a little British style, symbolic anti-Semitic language and said, we're not putting up with that. If they can hold that line, that's a sign of social health. But yeah, I think on a lot of economic issues, I think the country is going to go farther to the left than it would have been had Hillary Clinton won in 2016.
Well, the Green New Deal obviously created lots of talking points for Republicans. And you know that if Donald Trump gets reelected, it will be because the perception is that yes, he may be awful, but we have another Flight 93 election. And, AOC is going to, take away your airplanes and, address government regulations to cow farts and all of that stuff. And you and I have both watched how effective those kinds of narratives and memes can be.
Well, Democrats have to make some tough decisions from a political point of view. I mean, Donald Trump clearly wants whoever the Democrats actually nominate. He wants to run against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar. He's going to make them the ticket. And so the Democrats are going to have to do some work. And because those two women are both such publicity seekers, the Democrats are going to have to do some work to get them off the stage and to say they are not the face of our party. As for the Green New Deal itself, I mean, the thing about it is, I forget now how many points it has. It is, there's a transition from sense to nonsense mm-hmm. halfway through it. I believe that man-made climate change is a real problem. And as always with problems, we respond to them with market mechanisms. And as always with market problems, you solve the cheapest problems first, right? You're trying to make your company more efficient. You start with the easy things. The hard things you deal with later. So I'm in favor of a carbon tax. So when they start saying things like, we need to think about how we decarbonize our cities. Yeah, that makes sense. It's going to make sense to a lot of moderate minded voters. And yeah, and shifting from the payroll, cutting the payroll tax and creating a carbon tax instead, and incentivizing transitions to less carbon intensive. And then about halfway through, they said, and that's why we need to transition from profit as the organizing principle.
Yeah.
And it just goes to mania. And that means there has to be jobs for everybody, whether they want to work or not. And that means, you know, and you think, what? That means socialist youth camp with matching little scarves, little berets. And you think, so the task for, and look, the Democrats have been better at this in the recent past than the Republicans have, is to say your activist base creates energy and they identify issues and they mix sense with nonsense. And how do you have a responsible approach? Climate change is a real problem. How do you have a responsible approach? How do you solve this in the cheapest way? Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm going on.
No. I worry that you may have the AOCs of the world toxify solutions to climate change in the way that Donald Trump has toxified the wall. I mean, there are legitimate concerns about border security, and yet you're never going to see an agreement about about barriers. I mean, he's made that just simply too divisive. And I wonder whether there's the danger that, because I do agree with you, I think there's a moment for bipartisan cooperation on the issue of climate change. You just sort of sense that there is a shift, and that I'm not sure that the Green New Deal advanced that.
For
the reasons you just said, because they had so many distractions to it.
Well, it's like the barriers. So there's been a barrier between Tijuana and San Diego for something like 20 years. And absolutely, in high traffic foot corridors, it makes sense. And that's why there is already, a third of the Mexican-U.S. border is fenced. And it's very possible that there are areas of that border that would benefit from more fencing. Very possible. That's a completely practical matter. What Donald Trump has done is said, when I say wall, I want you all to understand what I mean is I hate Mexicans. and wall means I hate Mexicans. And at that point, a lot of people said, well, if you meant there's this area where we're getting a lot of foot traffic and people are dying, and if you could divert the flow into other areas that could be more effectively policed, where illegal immigrants can be turned back and drugs can be intercepted, and if that's what you meant, yeah, for sure. Like with the first 700 miles, we were for that. If what you mean is we don't hate Mexicans, they're our neighbors, and so they're Mexican Americans, and they're our friends, and we have to have a good relationship. And as you say, you toxify it. And the same thing with the Green New Deal. If what it means is we Americans can achieve a rising standard of living while emitting less carbon per person and mitigating these climate risks, I think that's a classic suburban environmental issue. If what it means is we want to get rid that the way we organized our free economy for the past 200 years has to be overhauled and replaced. Americans have been pretty clear. If what you mean is central control and socialism, we've never been for that, and we're never going to be.
And you put your finger on the way it plays out in 2020, those swing suburban voters who I think would be more than willing to vote for a candidate who had a rational policy on the environment and yet might be repelled by a more extreme view. All right, I want to move on to it because I want to talk about something that you and I talked about. I'm now trying to think, probably 2 years ago, when I was hosting a show on public radio in New York, you had just come out with a really frightening piece in the Atlantic. After Trump's election on authoritarianism, and you probably remember this piece, and we talked about it, about the real threat to democratic norms. Now, over the last 2 years, there have been a lot of people saying, all right, well, the worst case scenarios have not occurred, these norms have actually, I mean, our institutions have in fact been more resilient than we might have expected. So give me your sense now, 2 years on, about the authoritarian threat, to what extent it was overstated, or to what extent you think the things that you had identified in fact still pose a threat.
Well, I then went on to turn that article into a book. And at the beginning of the book, I said, I'm conscious as I write this book that in an ideal world, I'm writing too early. That I am going to say things at a time when we don't know what's going to happen. And I'm going to make predictions that have a high risk of being wrong. But when you're confronting a danger, it's more important to speak early when there's a chance of doing something, even at the risk of being mistaken. than to wait too long and to be then perfectly correct in all your analysis. But it's all behind you. So here's what I would say in retrospect, looking back on him, about Trump's personal authoritarianism. I think there's no question. I mean, his impulse, his identification with dictators, his use of the Stalinist language of enemies of the people, they're just trace elements about what he is. It's also true he has no work ethic, no understanding of the mechanics of government, and a tremendous psychic neediness, all of which get in the way of being a really effective authoritarian leader. He didn't do the work to know it's not just enough to have the attorney general on your side, you also have to have the deputy attorney general on your side. He didn't know that. Generally, and the good news is the legal system has really held. It's proven remarkably robust. The court, and not just the courts, but the professionals of the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's offices. Donald Trump calls for his opponents, his political opponents, to be prosecuted, and nothing happens. So that's good news. The bad news is that the political system has not held. And I think what we are really seeing is a shift. And this is a special problem for the Republican side, mm-hmm. where Republicans have always believed we speak for the silent majority. Our voters may be disaffected from the political system, but if you can get a real leader out there, send a real conservative message, it will mobilize people and we will have a majority on our side. And that began to be more and more disappointed. I think one of the things that conservatives have woken up to in the Trump years is that's not true. It is not a majority. It's a plurality. It's the biggest block of the electorate, but it's not a majority. And you see ticks like that. You'll see the people who are in the Trump world say the American people elected Trump to do this. Well, that's not quite what happened. But I think what you're seeing is for the first time the birth of a conscious, not just not knowing what they're doing, but a conscious decision by leading figures in the conservative world that democracy itself is a problem.
Yes. No, I think that is exactly right. That you know, everything about Trump that you said is true, but he's too incompetent and too lazy to necessarily pose a threat. But he's created this taste, and he's fed into this growing taste for the strong man to override all of the normal checks and balances. And you just watch the reaction to the emergency declaration. That you have this appetite out there now and a constituency among quote unquote former constitutional conservatives for extreme actions. You know, there are real consequences to, you know, everything being Flight 93. If everything's Flight 93, you don't take a vote. You don't worry about niceties and procedure and the concern for the rights of minority. And you know, we had a post up at the Bulwark. I have to actually check his name because he's come out of the closet. His name is Christian Vanderbrook, who basically talks about, you know, how Trump is making authoritarianism great again. And, you know, by focusing on, you know, people, columnists, you know, people on Fox and Friends, the Lou Dobbs of the world, even Hugh Hewitt, you know, people calling on a former law clerk, you know, calling on the president to openly defy a federal court. And you get that drumbeat that in fact, the window has been shifted by Donald Trump and that will be a problem even after Donald Trump leaves the scene.
Yes. There's something very Argentine about it. And it reflects a sense of the conservative-minded people have lost confidence that the country's with them. But they haven't given up on their conservatism. And the state of national emergency, I mean, is a perfect example. So the emergency doesn't solve any problem for Donald Trump because we remain, as I said, the legal system is holding. So this declaration of national emergency gives the president the power to move money from one military construction pocket to another military construction project, and in particular to take money from projects that have been approved by Congress but not yet contracted and redeploy it. So what happens when you get that authority? Well, what you discover is every one of those projects has a political patron. They didn't become approved because no one in Congress wanted them. Somebody in Congress wanted that project very, very much, sometimes for reasons of merit. But the projects you want even more, the projects that are not merit. Right. Like anybody can be for a project with merit, but it takes real commitment to the projects, for the pork barrel projects. Mm. So there's, for example, a project in Kentucky for $60 million to build a new aircraft hangar at a base. Does Mitch McConnell want to see that $60 million taken away? There's a $100 million-plus project in North Carolina at the Marine Corps Air Base there. Does Tom Tillis not care about that? What Trump is going to discover is every time he takes the money, he's taking it from somebody powerful. Now, there's a project in Hawaii. It's got Democratic senators, so maybe he can take that money. And the single the biggest block of the money he's going to take is $2.5 billion in counter-narcotics work. And from exactly the place where the DEA wanted to spend the money to stop drugs, he's going to move to a place where the DEA says that's a much lower priority. So he's not going to escape. So why did anybody think this was a good idea? Because it was a symbolic assertion of arbitrary power. And if you don't know the details, it felt good, at least at first.
Well, as a symbolic exercise of arbitrary power, then to watch Republican members of Congress endorse it, I think is deeply troubling. You know, in terms of the surrendering of constitutional prerogatives, something that would have been very, very hard to imagine, and I think is going to have long term consequences. Because I think one of the things that we've learned over the last several years is that many of these democratic norms are much thinner on the ground. We call them norms because some of them are not necessarily written into statutes. They're habits. They're assumptions that may not be grounded in political reality. And they're also based on a kind of an honor system with the assumption that the people making these decisions would be honorable. And all of those premises, I think, are being challenged.
And there's one more thing they're based on, and this is something that we didn't recognize it was there until it was gone. A lot of the way that Congress worked when it worked well was based on the shared experience of the World War II generation. Mm-hmm. We had for 40 years, we had a Congress in which at first it was dominated by veterans, and later, even as the veterans began to fade out, where the veterans had the most prestige. And where people had a habit of working together. You had a secret hierarchy. You had people in Congress who had been very brave during the war. And they would have then a prestige. Think of John Solomon, who used to represent upstate New York, who I think won the Congressional Medal of Honor. And he was one of the people who went to tell Nixon it was time to resign. And John, he wasn't an especially powerful member of the House. I think he sat on the Veterans Affairs Committee, chaired it probably. But everyone knew what he had done when the bullets were whizzing. And when he came to you and said, "You disappointed me," that had a special kind of force. So the members now come from much more different experiences, and they've lost that sense of commonality. And that's one of the things that upheld the norms. And we're going to have to find a way to and what I worry – here's the thing I worry about most is what we will end up doing post-Trump is taking a lot of things that weren't written down and writing them down and maybe putting them into law. But the effect of that is the United States is a country, a very legalistic country, and Americans tend to assume if something is not against the law, then it's okay to do.
Right.
And the more law you have, the more you think, okay, everything that's not against the law is okay.
You know, I was actually present at an event where I think you were the moderator, a discussion of the post-Watergate reforms in Congress back in the 1970s. And many of those reforms in retrospect actually made things worse. They didn't make things better.
I think that's right. I think that we've been going down the wrong path on campaign finance for a long time. We keep thinking that and every time we do a big plan, we're always surprised at the end that things are actually worse and the money's more secret and less accountable. And at some level, we have to say maybe we've had the wrong approach. And some of the post-Watergate reforms are very good, and some of them are now in trouble. And one of the most important, from my point of view, of the post-Watergate reforms, I shouldn't say the most, but one of the most important, was the creation of House and Senate Intelligence Committees to create congressional oversight of intelligence agencies, something that did not exist before the middle 1970s. And those institutions have been very badly damaged by the Trump years. And I wonder whether we've not given the FBI and CIA more independence in a fight where Congress was so in the wrong and the agencies were in the right. And next time when the agencies are maybe in the wrong and Congress is in the right, they're not going to want to listen to Congress.
Yeah, let me ask you a tough question then, going back to this whole question of the norms being upheld by that shared experience. How do we ever get that back? I'm acknowledging that it's a hard question because sort of the nature of society, you know, seems to be centrifugal right now. That rather than having shared experiences, we seem to be dividing in so many different subcategories. Is there anything on the horizon that you think, and for lack of a better word, is going to heal or fix this problem? You know, create a shared narrative, some sort of shared experience that's going to bring us out on the other end of Trumpism.
Well, we never go back. You always have to go on. Mm-hmm. And so what you try to do as you go on is say, what am I trying to achieve? So I agree with you that the thing that, for me, the lesson of Trump years is we need a stronger sense of American nationhood. And as the country becomes more diverse, that becomes ever more important, because if we're not a nation as compared to other nations, then we're tribes within the nation. And one of the reasons that I think so many conservatives have been so blithe about what Russia did was say, well, the Russians are at least white. So I'd rather, you know, be ruled by white Russians than by fellow Americans of a different hue. So you have to create that sense of, you know, and whatever the look of the person's hue, that person who is a fellow citizen, you have more in common with him than with a person of similar ethnicity abroad. So how do you reinforce the nation? And I think I have a couple of, I think we need a, and this is the thing I'm going to say in The Atlantic next month, we need a much more restrictive immigration policy so that we can digest the people we've taken over the past 40 years and make, build again a sense of American commonality. But we're also going to need a strong, and this is the thing where I continue to say I'm conservative, but not a conservative. We're going to need a stronger state that delivers material benefits to people, including health care. One of the differences between the United States on the one hand and Canada and Britain on the other, in Australia, I've never been there, but I assume, is that when you say to a Canadian or a Brit, how do you know who you are as opposed to other people? Well, they say, I got this card. I can walk into a hospital and somebody else can't. It's not just a feeling. It's not just a banner in the breeze. I actually get something for being a Canadian or for being British and just for being here. I get it. And for not being here, you can't have it. It doesn't matter how nice you are. It doesn't matter how much, maybe my cousin, but if you live in Ireland, you can't have my British healthcare.
So you don't think Social Security, Medicare do that? Or
I think they do, but I think we're going to need Social Security absolutely does. And Medicare does it for the over 65s. But the problem is the over 65 population is so ethnically different from the under 65 population. The strength of Medicare is one of the things that is dividing the country. As I said, I'm not for Medicare for all, but the concept of it is to say, you know what, you need to bring Asian, Hispanic, white, and black Americans all into the same healthcare system. Because Medicare is a white system and Medicaid is a non-white system.
You know, you mentioned something interesting about the fact that people aren't upset about Russia because they are at least ethnically white, which, of course, raises the question that we touched on a little bit earlier. Donald Trump's absolute fascination with Vladimir Putin, and among the freaky stories that we've had over the last week, and it's hard to keep track sometimes, that story from Andrew McCabe about the intelligence briefing where Donald Trump said that he didn't think that the North Koreans had the missile capability of reaching the United States because Putin had told him. And they, you know, once he was told, no, the intelligence agencies disagree with that, he said, well, I don't believe them. I believe Putin, which amazing. It is amazing. And Do you sometimes feel, by the way, that the one of the real dangers of this particular era is that we just get exhausted by all of this, that you just get exhausted by keeping track of it. You get exhausted by shaking your head. You get exhausted by being outraged by all of this.
I think that's so true. But I'll repeat something I said in another context where somebody said to me in a public event, I just get so tired of reading the news. I totally understand how you feel. But if you remember when your children were small and they got feverish and you had to sit by their bed all night, you got tired of that too. But you didn't leave the bed until the kid was well.
That is a good analogy. And we do this for a living, so we have to sit by the bed. There's no exit. There's no place for us to go. David Frum, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
What a pleasure to be here.
We could go on and, best of luck. I now have a greater appreciation of what it means to be a pariah. So just don't misinterpret my use of the word. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.